Thank you for tuning into our podcast, History's Top 3, brought to you by the History Department of the U.S. Naval Academy, located in Annapolis, Maryland. In this show, we will discuss and debate some of the key turning points, trends, and major figures of world history. Our goal is to explore the varied landscapes and seascapes of the past in the hopes of shedding some light on the way the present world came to be. In our studio today are our three co-hosts, Professor Thomas Burgess, Commander Andy Cox, and myself, Captain Bob Q. All of us are instructors and lifelong students of history. In this new season of the Top 3, each of us will present our top choice for today's theme. We will then discuss how we made our choices and why we believe they deserve a place in the Top 3. We invite you to share your thoughts and engage in the discussion. Today, we will be discussing the top three most eccentric rulers. And we're actually going to do something a little bit different today. We're going to talk about what exactly it means for a ruler to be eccentric. Gentlemen, what do you think? How are you defining eccentric in how you made your choices for today?
I try to make the distinction between eccentric and psychotic. I eliminate a lot of people from contention just because I thought that they were murderous or cruel or violent, so much so that they belonged in a different category altogether.
I agree. I thought there's lots of options for what eccentric means, and I'm sure it changes in every period and for the people who are living under these rulers. But for me, an eccentric couldn't be this homicidal maniac who happened to be in charge. An eccentric needed to be strange or out of the norm. They might cause harm to those they ruled or to others, but that wasn't the thing we necessarily remember them for or what they're known for.
Yeah, I think there's this really interesting point we all make in that clearly someone who is eccentric is outside the conventions, the circle of what is normal, but they can't be too far outside it. There's a little bit of a needle they have to thread between being just unconventional, being a little bit outside established norms, but they can't go so far that they're considered depraved or insane. And I think also there's the point that we want to not talk about people who, you know, just have legitimate mental illnesses.
Yeah, I think that's also, you bring up a very good point in that what was considered insane or mental illness of the periods that we're going to talk about is different. And looking back, I think you can really see some of these people are obviously dealing with mental illness. And for me, when I looked at that, I don't think you could necessarily divorce mental illness as either the cause or a correlation with some of their behavior. But I was trying not to, I tried to look for a ruler who that was not the only cause, or maybe even the predominant cause. As we'll see in these, I have no doubt that some of these guys did struggle with mental illness, but I don't think that was the only thing going on.
Right. And I think you also make a really good point about how what exactly is conventional depends on the time period, right? There's certain social and period norms for what is conventional. And so what is considered eccentric actually depends a little bit on the specific context we're talking about. Great. So as the host, I'm going to take the prerogative of talking about my pitch first.
Oh, here we go.
And the person I have selected for today is an individual named Gaius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, better known as Caligula. So I know what many of you are probably thinking. Caligula, I'm pretty sure that guy was a little bit more than just eccentric. I'm pretty sure he's too far in the other direction. You know, Caligula is one of the most legendarily bad Roman emperors. His name is essentially synonymous with insanity and depravity. Almost everyone knows at least some of the stories about him. How he demanded to be worshipped as a god, or how he pretended to have his soldiers attack the ocean and take seashells as trophies, or perhaps the most famous story about him when he proposed to make his horse a consul. However, what I would argue, and that many historians have actually begun to argue, is that Caligula's story is one of the most successful character assassinations in history. And the thing to remember is the political context and who was writing about him. Caligula became emperor in the still the relatively early days of the Roman Empire, and the first emperor, Augustus, had made it a point to loudly proclaim his support for tradition and the power of Senate, all the while he was busily making himself a military dictator. So Caligula had the misfortune of living at this awkward point where the truth and the fiction started to clash. His early reign was actually pretty successful. He built aqueducts, even restored some limited elections, you know, basically did all the things that emperors were expected to do. But what got him was his unwillingness to keep up the fiction that the Senate had anything approaching real power. That eventually led him into open conflict with senators, the same senators who ultimately helped plot his assassination, and then the same senators who were the ones who wrote all the histories about him. And most of the most interesting stories about him, if you view them through this lens, become less like insanity and more like calculated, albeit kind of unconventional or arrogant ways to prove a political point. For example, his proposal to make his horse a consul was probably a jab at how pointless that position had become. Of course, that meant it was also incredibly insulting to the senators who still vied for the position, even though it didn't hold any more real power. And his weird demand that his soldiers collect seashell seems connected in the sources to reports about army mutinies around the time of a proposed invasion of Britain. In other words, you can interpret it as a way of calling out the soldiers as cowards for refusing to attack Britain. Like, oh, you think you're so brave? Great, take some seashells as trophies. And as a military officer myself, I can think of many similarly pointless things that folks have been made to do in the military that I myself may have been made to do at one point. Things like mopping the parade deck in the rain. Even the fact that he's known by Caligula demonstrates part of the bias of the sources. Most historians now actually would call him Gaius after his first given name. He actually hated the name Caligula. He was given the name as a diminutive of Caliga, which is the Latin word for boots. And he was called that because he accompanied his father, a famous general, on campaign. He wore these little boots. But even the term little boots, I think, doesn't quite capture the cutesy nature of it. Bootsy wootsies, right, might be a better transliteration or a better translation of what Caligula actually meant, which is incredibly insulting thing for a grown man to be called, let alone an emperor. And the fact that we know him as this, I think, is a great continuing legacy of the fact that his histories were written by people who hated him. Gaius is ultimately murdered, replaced with another emperor who was more willing to humor the Senate's continued delusions of importance. But his eccentricity, in many ways, put him ahead of his time. The longer the empire continued, the more ridiculous these delusions seemed, and the more future emperors adopted many of the same supposedly insane practices he had adopted, like being worshipped as a god.
What a fascinating take on the life of Caligula, a revisionist account. I was just curious, Bob, was there anything about Caligula that was unquestionably eccentric that seems to still strike people as just weird?
Yeah, I think what you're getting at, Thomas, is this really good question about, you know, what can we actually believe or know about him, given how much bias we have in the sources? And I think the point that a lot of historians have started to make now is that a lot of the stuff that he did was not necessarily completely out of the pale, right? Everyone kind of knew at this point that the Roman emperor was a military dictator and that the Senate didn't really have any real power, right? But what he did that was just kind of weird and insulting and kind of pissed off the right people was he kind of made a big deal about it, and he kind of brought up and exposed this issue in a very public and insulting light. And, you know, a great example is the fact that, hey, you know, if he had chosen to make his 8-year-old nephew or 8-year-old grandson a consul, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been as bad, because that was actually something that emperors did all the time. It was one of their ways of showing that this nephew or this grandchild had favor, maybe was a potential successor, and no one really bad an eye, right? Like, everyone kind of knew it was weird, but it wasn't completely outside of the pale of what was normal. And the implicit understanding is that it doesn't really matter that this 8-year-old is the consul, because the consul doesn't really do anything anymore. But the fact that he would go and make his horse a consul is a way of making that point in kind of a way that is both insulting and a little bit beyond what the senators were willing to tolerate.
Really tears the fiction away from the arrangement.
Exactly, right, exactly. And the fact is that even the ancient written sources don't say that he actually did it, right? They just say that he talked about it. And so you can easily see him just kind of making this offhand remark about how, oh, consuls don't do anything. I could even make my horse a consul and it wouldn't change anything in the Roman Empire. And all the senators just clutching their pearls and saying, oh, did you hear what Caligula did?
He was trolling.
He was trolling.
Indeed.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right? And for me, that's what brings him, you know, back into the eye of the needle between insane, depraved, cruel, sadistic, power-hungry towards merely eccentric. Because given the conventions of the time, he wasn't necessarily doing anything that Roman emperors weren't already doing.
I love this pick because I was – the way you started it as everyone knows Caligula, yes, this is what I thought about Caligula. And your description, especially of what more modern historians are starting to re-examine here, I think flips the script really in a really interesting way here. Dealing with historiography, the building and the study of history itself is always really hard, and with ancient sources is notorious. There are so few of them, and they usually come from very biased observers. Like in this case,
right,
Everyone who's writing about Caligula is an enemy of Caligula.
Right.
So what do you think this case can tell us about what we know about eccentric or popular or reviled rulers?
Yeah, I think you raise a really great question. This is actually one of the reasons I enjoy talking about ancient sources, especially when I'm trying to teach students about historiography, because I think sometimes historiography is an intimidating term for students, but then you're like, oh, it's just people talking about people. And the ancient Roman senators are just such gossip obsessed, you know, it's like the National Enquirer, except 3,000 years old, 2,000 years old, so everybody feels like it's probably right. I think what it shows us is that we have to read these sources very, very carefully, especially given the known biases of the people who write them. And whenever possible, try to corroborate that with sources that are not written sources, right? And so, you know, one of the great examples about Caligula is that many of the written sources talk about how, oh, you know, during his reign, there was a massive financial crisis, for lack of a better term. You know, the treasury was starting to run dry because he was spending so much money on all of these profligate, extravagant things. But then if you look at, for instance, the coins that we have surviving from his era, they're all good coins, which actually goes against what you would expect, because the first thing an emperor would do if he started running into financial issues is start debasing their coinage. And so you have to kind of bounce this back and forth between other forms of evidence. And I think Caligula, you know, is a great example of how you need to do that to really get to the truth of some of these people.
To ping pong off of that, my pick is King Ludwig II of Bavaria. Now, Germans have many names for him, such as the Swan King or the Fairy Tale King, but most everyone else would know him as Mad King Ludwig. He was named Louis II of Bavaria, and he was born in 1845 in Munich, when Germans did not yet have their own country and were being increasingly pulled between Austria and Prussia. Ludwig ascended the throne at age 18, and after the German nation had really solidified, ruled Bavaria as a state within the German Empire. So suffice to say, the political climate of the late 19th century demands a lot of attention from the rulers. But his disillusionment with German unification seems to have driven him away from politics, and instead, Ludwig focused on personal projects that became some of Bavaria's most important cultural legacies. He also demonstrated a lot of strange behaviors that drove his ministers nuts and still defy easy understanding, even by today's experts. Very soon after he'd taken the throne, he developed a relationship with Richard Wagner, the popular composer who wrote so many well-known operas like The Ring Cycle, right, and others, steeped in German mythology. Now, young Ludwig was so enamored with these stories, with opera and theater in general, and with Wagner himself, to the point that he wrote about giving up his throne to study and be with Wagner, that his ministers ended up expelling Wagner from the city of Munich to separate them. But Ludwig remained hooked on myths and fables and the Bavarian countryside that he loved, so he turned his efforts to art and architecture. And here, his cultural inspirations really start to merge with a bent towards the grand and even the autocratic. Ludwig greatly admired King Louis XIV of France, the Sun King, among others. And he built three new castles over the 1870s and 1880s. Schloss Herrenchiemsee, a copy of Versailles Palace that was never completed, the Linderhof Palace, and Neuschwanstein, an opulent fairy tale looking castle on a steep precipice near a lake. And that's the inspiration for Walt Disney World and the castle in Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah.
So by the 1880s, however, he has started to really withdraw from society and becomes almost nocturnal, where he's getting up at 5 p.m. and he's wandering his halls and doing his artistic projects. He's kind of living like a vampire. he would host these elaborate dinners in these palaces that were attended by long dead monarchs, he said, and he would talk to them as if they were really sitting there. He believed he was descended from the Bourbon dynasty through baptism. He experienced hallucinations and he formed outlandish schemes. He would exit buildings out of the windows instead of using the doors. He was also a closeted homosexual, which at the time was considered a scandal and was publicly criticized for it. Now, eventually, his lifestyle and the building projects, which were all self-funded or using personal loans, had racked up so much debt that it endangered the family. And at one point, he seems to have seriously considered robbing a bank. So his statesmen got together and they tried to convince him to abdicate. And when that failed, a team of doctors diagnosed him with paranoia, what they called madness, without even seeing him physically. They did this from a distance. He was deposed and replaced by his uncle as Prince Regent, and he was moved to Schlossberg Castle in the company of a psychiatrist. And what makes this story tragic and strange is that only about 3 days later, Ludwig was found dead in the lake on the castle grounds, along with the doctor assigned to him, under very mysterious circumstances. But his cultural legacy far outshines the conspiratorial nature of his death, and he remains a popular, if unorthodox, historical figure in late German history.
Yeah, this story strikes a really personal chord with me because I actually grew up with a poster of Neuschwanstein on my bedroom wall as a kid.
Oh, wow.
And I took German classes, and I just one day promised myself I would one day see this castle on the cliff. Never have done so, but someday. Anyway, but my question really is about his death. Such a mysterious death. And maybe you can elaborate a bit further.
It really was. So he turns up drowned in the lake with the psychiatrist doctor assigned to him, also drowned, only 3 days after having been moved to that castle. And it fueled, over time, it fueled ideas of assassination or attempts of escape that maybe Ludwig was known as a strong swimmer. And so for him to have drowned is strange in its own right. But maybe he was trying to swim across the lake where agents were going to smuggle him out into Austria and the doctor tried to stop him. Or maybe Ludwig really did have trouble swimming this day and the doctor tried to save him and they both drowned. Or others have postulated maybe he was actually shot. And since the body is sealed in the family tomb and no one has been able to examine it, that there is a conspiracy afoot here. But the fact that he was deposed, declared insane by doctors who never met him before that, and then dead within 3 days of being moved has fueled over the years some conspiratorial ideas about how and why he died. I don't have any good answers on that other than he seems to have died by drowning, which is strange in its own right.
You know, I feel kind of bad for this guy. You know, he seems like a guy who was just very artistic, just wanted to listen to his operas and, you know, work on his architecture and had the misfortune of having some very different expectations for what his life should have been like. And I think it's interesting because some of the things that he has left behind, things like, you know, Wagner's Ring Cycle or even the castles that he built, which from my understanding are possible candidates as UNESCO World Heritage Sites for Germany. It's a good legacy, right? What is his legacy like today among modern day Germans?
My understanding is he's definitely known as an eccentric. Compared with the other rulers of the period, like Otto von Bismarck and the Kaiser, he's not this political heavyweight. But I think you can argue that his castles really are the biggest tourist attractions Bavaria has, aside from maybe, the Oktoberfest?
Right.
which is big in Bavaria, but it's not just Bavaria. So maybe his eccentricity, his artistic bent, is actually a better investment than anyone realized. It's not just good for the arts, it's good for the economy.
Yeah.
At the time, Ludwig just does not fit the mold for what Germans, and I think even people like us looking back, would expect out of a monarch, especially in the late 1800s.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Thomas had a poster of his castle, so clearly very influential legacy.
Yes, and if anyone listening to this has not seen a picture of Neuschwanstein, I highly recommend you Google it. It is a gorgeous looking building, and you can definitely see where Disney got the inspiration from.
Sir, thank you very much for that entry. We'll move now to our final entry, which is actually the most modern ruler on the list. Thomas, do you want to kick it off?
Sure. King Farouk, who ruled Egypt from 1936 to 1952, began his reign under extremely favorable circumstances. Unlike his father, he actually spoke Arabic, the language of his subjects, as well as English, French, and Italian. He was also handsome, tall, and slim as a young man who made a point of cultivating a reputation for Muslim piety. Wherever he went in Egypt, adoring crowds greeted him. His Cairo coronation outdid that of the King of England in pomp and splendor. An audience of millions of poor farmers heard him say at his coronation, "The poor are not responsible for their poverty, but rather the wealthy. A king is a good king when the poor of the land have the right to live, when the sick have the right to be healed, when the timid have the right to be tranquil, and when the ignorant have the right to learn." If this is indeed the measure of a good king, then Farouk failed miserably. Growing up in the royal palace, his servants approached him on their knees and kissing his feet. When still a boy, his various tutors became convinced he was incapable of concentration, preferring instead to play childish pranks. As king, he inherited a fortune worth nearly $2 billion in today's money, along with 5 palaces, 200 cars, and 75,000 acres of prime land along the Nile River. Yet this was never enough. On visits to the homes of the Egyptian elite, he frequently helped himself to whatever he fancied, whether it was a new painting, antique, or even the daughter of the house. After taking lessons in picking pockets, he managed to steal Winston Churchill's pocket watch, a priceless family heirloom that had been in his family for generations. During World War II, as Axis armies invaded Egypt from the west, Farouk spent night after night in the Cairo nightclubs, where he collected mistresses and hobnobbed with the rich and famous. He gorged himself on 300 oysters a week, wow, the finest French foods, and became obese. Involved in a car accident, he broke 2 ribs. The stretcher carrying him broke due to his massive weight. Yet he extended his time in the British Army hospital just so he could flirt with the nurses. After the war, he was away for months on long European holidays. He lost millions in the Monaco casinos, acquired yet more mistresses, and ruined his image in the eyes of his poor and suffering subjects back home, many of whom suffered from bilharzia, cholera, and other easily preventable diseases. Finally, in 1952, Farouk was overthrown in a coup and forced into exile. In one of his abandoned palaces were discovered 2,000 silk shirts, 10,000 silk ties, and the world's largest porn collection. After another dozen years of high and riotous living in Rome, his gluttony eventually got the better of him. He collapsed after an especially heavy meal of oysters and lamb, having literally eaten himself to death. He was only 45. Since he died the way he lived, one can at least say he was true to his principles.
Wow, Thomas, that is quite a litany of irresponsible behavior. I have to admit, I did not know who this guy was before we prepared for today, and that is a story. I guess I would ask about Farouk. Do you think his overthrow was, can we put a lot of that mostly on his own personal choices and foibles and irresponsibility, or do you think when he was ruling Egypt in the Great Depression, World War II, and the Cold War post-war period, is that just a period that is more and more intolerant of bad monarchs?
Yeah, I think he was given many chances to kind of mend his ways, and he just never got the message that he was living in a different time when demands for social justice were on the rise and communism worldwide had greater and greater appeal. Even within his own country, there was actually a very, very active Egyptian Communist Party at this time, and the British were worried that if Farouk continued doing what he was doing, there might be some sort of communist takeover because he was offending so many people, and the people were remaining poor and miserable, and he didn't seem to care despite, you know, some rhetoric otherwise. So yeah, he was just basically unwilling to change with the times, and he, for a while there, he was trying to present himself as a Muslim gentleman, and that was an appeal to popular aspirations. They wanted someone like him who wasn't so secular, say, as the nationalist politicians. But as by the last years of his reign, he just was completely out of step. They wanted a strong ruler who could stand up to the Israelis, the British, and he just was neither of these things. He was as corrupt as the day is long.
Certainly, I bet shortened his reign.
Yeah, you know, there's this really interesting point that, you know, Farouk was probably never going to be a good ruler no matter when he lived.
Yeah, right? I would subscribe to that.
But you can kind of imagine him being this, you know, Ottoman vizier or something, and everyone's like, oh, well, that's just Farouk. Let him eat his oysters and his lamb. He's harmless. But he just happened to live in this period in which you needed more from a ruler, right, because of all the backgrounds that we were talking about.
Yeah, I can also add that he was followed everywhere by paparazzi, so he was, his misdoings and his excesses, right, were publicized in a way that it wasn't always the case with an Ottoman sultan or some other example of conspicuous consumption.
Right. And, you know, I think this raises a really interesting question. You know, for each of the entries, each of the rulers we've talked about today, you know, how much of their eccentricity is because of who they are, and how much of it do we think is because of the times in which they were living? You know, could we pluck any of these people, put them in a different time, and have them maybe not even make the list?
I think that's a really interesting question, Bob. When I think about Ludwig, I kind of agree with you. He's a sympathetic character. I feel a little bad for him. And I tend to think, yeah, his eccentricities meant he wasn't a very good ruler in some cases. But I also think the times he lived in demanded extraordinary amounts of talent and ability and attention. And right. I can't help but think, like, if Ludwig had lived earlier, here is a ruler of a maybe not a small, insignificant state, but a smaller state than, say, like the Austrian Empire, any of these.
Sure.
A guy very focused on his own pursuits. And I don't know how many monarchs in Europe could have gotten away with all of that through the rest of the Middle Ages and early modern period. I think Ludwig might have been fine. You know, a noteworthy person who made great art or architecture, perhaps, but that was about it. And instead, he's this sort of almost tragic, eccentric figure in the late 19th century.
Yeah. I could see him also doing well more recently. He could be a cultural ambassador as King of Bavaria.
He could focus
on cultural festivals and cultural, you know, events of whatever kind. He could be a promoter of the arts and all these things. He'd be perfectly happy and accepted as such.
Yeah, and, you know, I think part of it is the way we've constructed this category, which is eccentric rulers. And, you know, by definition, we're not just looking at eccentric people. We're looking at rulers, you know, people who have to wield power, you know, military might, influence, leadership. And I think oftentimes for rulers, there's even more expectation that they have to behave in a certain specific way, right? You know, nowadays, most monarchs don't really have much power, and they can easily sponsor nice causes and, you know, go to operas and do all of that. But, you know, in each of the periods we're talking about a period in which rulers were supposed to behave in a certain way.
I feel like each of these rulers we've talked about is also living and acting in a period of transition where what's expected of them is increasingly in conflict with how they want to behave. And like the old norms are butting up against new realities, whether this is ancient Rome or the new post-war period or the late 19th century. And that some of these expectations, when they're not met by Farouk or Ludwig, are increasingly intolerable, not just to elites, but to the mass media and the people themselves.
That's actually a really good point, because we've actually all picked rulers who are living in a very transitional time, right? Caligula, you know, the Roman Empire was relatively new. There are people alive who remembered when Rome was a republic. You know, so was the German Empire when Ludwig was alive. And then obviously with decolonization post-World War II, you're talking about a very stark change in the political system and the global political system, especially.
I can't imagine how angry Egyptians must have been looking at King Farouk hobnobbing with like the British or other people when they're just chafing after World War II to get rid of them, and you know, between the Suez Canal and all the other international issues that are so much more important to them.
Yeah, and you have also the Muslim Brotherhood that's catching on in terms
that's
of popularity,
right.
And they're preaching a very austere ascetic lifestyle. But I was thinking about Caligula here during all of this. I was wondering, could he live in the 20th century as an eccentric monarch? And I'm not sure he could probably survive wanting himself deified while still alive, or some of the pranks that he did. I'm not sure. That's just my impression.
Maybe not as a self-deified person, but I could see him as like a bomb-throwing politician in like, you know, the late 20th century.
A troll.
So I feel like he might have fit in.
Professional troll.
Yeah.
Royal
troll. I think of dictators like Gaddafi or even Saddam Hussein, who would build huge palaces with huge statues of themselves. I could see him fitting in that vein.
And there's some more names for the listeners to compare to the folks we brought up today.
There you go. You know, it's funny, when we started doing our research for this, I think we were all like, oh, this will be a fun, you know, we'll have some fun eccentric stories. And I think what we've realized is that what eccentric really means, it's actually a really deep question, right? What raises all of these issues about expectation and convention and time period, even historiography, which is probably the most unsexy topic for all historians to discuss. But, you know, it's cool to see how these stories have dredged up such rich themes. And while there's plenty more to debate on this subject, we'll save that for a round of drinks between friends. From all of us here at the U.S. Naval Academy, particularly at the History Department, thank you for tuning in.
This has been a production of the History Department at the U.S. Naval Academy, located in Annapolis, Maryland. If you enjoy our programs, please let us know, as we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can reach us on Twitter and Instagram at USNA History, and our email is historyproductions-group@usna.edu. For more information about the History Department at the Naval Academy, please visit usna.edu/history.